Hey, ¿qué pasa, Calexico? Welcome back to the podcast. Like always, before I begin, I want to thank my friends here at Calexico Brewing Company for allowing me to record today's episode here. I really appreciate it. Today, I have a guest that we've been kind of trying to get in this episode recorded, but since he's from San Diego and, you know, he comes every so often to Calexico, but he's a Calesiano, you know, from heart. He's an artist from San Diego, but he's, like I said, he's based from here in Calexico. His roots are in Calexico. My guest today is Ricardo Islas, or AKA, they call you Dicky Islands.
Dicky Islands, the English version of my name, Dick Islands.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I was gonna ask you where did that come from, but yeah, now I get it.
I think it was a conversation that came up. People talking about, you know, when they say, oh, what's your porn star name? And it's like your first pet and the street you grew up on. And I was like, well, I'll just change my name to English, Dick Islands.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of where it came from.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you grew up here in Calexico.
Yeah. I was born in 1970. Born in El Centro, but we lived here. So lived here till I was 20. And so then I went to high school here. I went to IVC.
Where did you graduate from high school?
88.
88.
Yeah.
Where in Calexico did you grow up?
Up until I was a freshman, I grew up on Heffernan Street, right by the Rockwood and the Little League. I grew up there. And then when I was a freshman, we bought a house off a cloak in the Nosotros Street.
Oh, okay.
So we moved over there. So my parents still live there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I still got a couple of sisters that live here in the Valley. They teach. All my sisters teach.
Oh, okay.
Some of them in the Bay Area and two here, one in El Centro, one in Calexico.
Oh, okay. Who's your...
One of them teaches at Blanche Charles.
Oh, okay.
The last name is Valenzuela, and the other one teaches at Central. The last name is Higgins.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I work here for the district, so...
Liz Valenzuela.
So growing up in Calexico, I was listening to the Emo Brown episode. Mm-hmm. Growing up, you were more of a metalhead, or
yeah, I was always into death metal and punk, the punk scene. So that's kind of like what I was all about.
But was it? Do you think it was just something that you? Because normally we tend to listen or like what our tios or our older brothers. Like, was it something that it was in your family or just...
No, because like in my house, even though we had records, like, nobody ever listened to music in my house, really. Like, they never had a radio on or anything. I mean, we went to parties in Mexicali. Yeah, we're listening to what they're playing. But in the household, they never really listened to music other than me. And I think since, like, junior high, I was listening to... like, say, rock, and then I started finding when stuff started getting heavier. And you know, back then you couldn't really listen to music. You just kind of took a chance on stuff. So you kind of went by the look of the band and this and that, or little clips that they wrote about it. And then me and my friends really got into the underground scene, like what nobody was listening to. So then we would go by record label. You know, like Blast Records or Megaforce or whatever. And we're looking at reviews. So we had to order stuff. There was no record store that at the time that had that kind of stuff, you know. So there was a music store in downtown Calexico. And we would just go in there and say, hey, I want to order this. I want to order that. Mm-hmm. And so we would just order stuff. And sometimes you got a dud, you know, it's like you're used to this. And then it's like, what the hell did they just put out? I know, like, the band Danzig and Misfits. Danzig put out an album, and I bought it. It's like, what the hell is this? This is like church music. I'm like, because you were just going by the label.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's something that I think the generations that are, you know, listening to music now, you know, take for granted that, you know, they have a chance to, and you don't even have to buy music anymore. You know, you
can,
you know, stream it or whatever. But, you know, back in the days, you know, you would, I mean, I grew up in the 90s. You grew up in, you know, the
70s, 80s.
And it was harder for you to kind of know, you know, if you're going to like the record or not. Yeah. Especially that type of music. I don't think it was something that was played on the radio, was it?
No, not at all. I mean, nobody heard that. I mean, even like I since like high school, for like 27 years, I had long hair. And I mean, nobody had long hair, so it was an automatic strip search at the customs. And I'm like, hey, how come you're harassing me? No, it's random. It's like, but every time.
Yeah.
So none of my friends ever want to walk across with me. So I'd go in and say, it's not random, dude. It happens every time. No, it's random. So they would like strip search or whatever. They check you in secondary. And then so I would walk back across when there was no lines back then, right?
Yeah.
I'd go right back in and come back, but go through another guy in secondary. And I'd go in there. Say, did you forget something? He goes, no, I'm just showing you it's not random. Like, I went back across and look, I'm here again.
Yeah.
You want me to try it again?
And that's the funny thing because, you know, I've always, you know, had short hair. Mm-hmm. Now I do it because I'm pretty much bald. So, And that's a like a stigma or not, you know, you kind of get the same treatment because, you know, they think, oh, you know, probably a cholo or whatever.
Probably a cholo.
Yeah. And it's funny because one time I work at a school.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the students was diagnosed with cancer, mm-hmm. so he lost his hair. So all the staff, you know,
yeah, shaved their heads.
And one time I went with a bunch of teachers to a concert in Mexicali,
mm-hmm.
and on our way back, you know, we got sent to secondary because it was a bunch of bald guys in the car. So it's like,
yeah, so it was that, and I mean, we made fun of it as like I started carrying everything, ID. School ID, birth certificate, so I would have everything I needed. And then when they were like strips, like I would go in there with my buddies because they get pulled in too. And we're like, hey, when they're checking your legs, fart. And it's like, hey, don't do that. I'm like, oh, it's just, I can't control it. It's a body function. And it just got, because it got so ridiculous that every time I went, and it's like, dude, if I get called in here every time, why would I try to carry something across the border?
Yeah.
If every time I'm getting thrown in here,
mm-hmm.
you know, so.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you know, I was going back to the Emo Brown podcast. I was listening to it and you were talking about how you kind of grew up working at Norm's.
Yeah. I grew up there since I was a little kid. My dad worked there for years. And so that was kind of my junior high school job. You know, I'd go in there and just stock, or they had a deli and they had ice cream. So, you know, do that, or just pretty much security, make sure people don't do a beer run, you know?
Yeah. I think beer runs were more common back in the
90s. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they didn't have cameras and stuff like that. So because now they have cameras and you could see like when somebody's like parked outside and they're like, kind of, you can tell when they're getting ready to.
Yeah, I think Norm's had like one camera and that was it. Like one camera.
Uh-huh.
And that was more like if they got robbed, you know.
Oh, and
not like really, for like a beer run.
Like in the register, kind
of. Yeah.
Do you remember, you know, what the downtown looked like when, you know, or what?
Yeah. We'd hang out there quite a bit. Like Fox Theater was like our babysitter, you know. Because we were like four kids and we drive, you know, my mom crazy sometimes, fighting or whatever, you know. So she's like, hey, we're going to drop you off and we'll pick you up hours later, you know. So I think we watched Grease like five times in a row, you know. And then they pick us up.
That's crazy.
So we'd go there, you know, and go to Sam Alley's because they had an elevator, you know. It's like the only place with an elevator. So like we'd go in there and go up and down. I'm sure they got annoyed, you know.
Yeah. Because now, you know, I mention it because now, I don't know if you've gone down there recently.
I haven't recently, but maybe a year ago I swung by and I know it's pretty deteriorated, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, so, but I haven't really gone and walked around or anything.
And you know, something that I I see that you, you know, not hang out, but you're in Barrio Logan, you know, quite often. And Barrio Logan was, you know, not, you know, like the best place to be a while back. And now it's, you know, a little bit better.
It's better, but stuff happens here and there. Like all of a sudden there'll be a little resurgence of, you know, a shooting or a stabbing or something. The barrio's still there,
okay.
You know? You can gentrify it, but the barrio's still there, you know? So, you know, and it kind of goes in waves. it was chill for a bit, and now it's kind of, you know, I usually try to get out of there by 10 o'clock, you know.
Yeah, especially with family.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, growing up listening to, like, rock, death metal and all that, did you ever listen to, like oldies or stuff like that? Because I grew up listening to all kinds of music, but oldies was something that is till this day, like, you know, something that I listened to.
Yeah, oldies I would say I did. But anything that was current, like when, like say when I was in high school, what everybody listened to, I couldn't stand. Because yeah. There was a lot of beef between, like the dudes that with long hair and the punk rockers with everybody that was listening to new wave. Mm. Like if I went to a club, I knew like somebody's going to try and jump me, you know, okay, I'm going to have to fight my way out of here, out of there. Like there was a lot of beef. So if that's where the beef was, I didn't want any part of it. Mm. So I was like, I didn't want to hear anything of Smiths or Cure or nothing and this and that. So it was, you know, oil and vinegar.
Yeah. Do you still not like the Smiths or the Cure or the Morrissey?
I don't like any of that music. It just seems depressing to me.
Yeah.
You know, but I do listen to other stuff that now, and I think when I moved up there and I was always hanging out in the bar scene. I love to go out. I've always gone out, and I started meeting different people and musicians and stuff. And so I started getting into other types of music. I still like what I like, but I like Latin jazz and I like jazz and I like, you know, pretty much everything other than country. I'm not a big country fan, but for some reason I can't stand the Smiths and and Morrissey and all that. And I don't know, it's something about it just seems too depressing to me or something.
Yeah, it's I mean, I listen to it, it is depressing, but I don't know, there's something that, and yeah. It's funny because a lot of, you know, people like especially Mexicans that yeah. immigrate here, they for some reason they love the Smiths and Morrissey.
Like my homie was the drummer for Los Smiths. And then I have another friend that has a barbershop and huge Morrissey fan, Smiths fan. His barbershop is called The Arsenal from Morrissey, right? And so they're all huge fans, but I'm just not, I don't know. It's just not my, I can't get into it.
Yeah, I think it's an acquired taste. Because yeah. I'll put it on and my wife doesn't like it.
Yeah, it's like early emo.
Yeah, yeah, it's probably like the first versions of emo music, yeah. So you grew up here in Calexico. You went to Calexico High School.
Yeah.
You graduated from here, and then you went to IVC.
I went to IVC for a couple years, and I had no idea what I was going to do. So I just started taking general requirements. And then a friend of mine was like, hey, take an auto shop class. Like, it's fun. And you just watch film strip and, you know, mess around if your car's broken. Whatever. I'm like, screw it. Because I needed 3 more credits for like financial aid.
Oh, okay.
All right, I'll do it. And it was fun and it was chill. So the next semester I needed 3 more units. So I took another one. And before you know it, I was taking nothing but auto shop classes. And then when it came time to get a job, like you could get a job in a shop here, but they were hiring everybody from Mexicali because they could pay a minimum wage. Mm. Where I thought, hey, you're a mechanic. Like, and the tools are expensive.
Yeah.
You know, I have $40,000 worth of tools. Like, how do you buy that on minimum wage?
Mm-hmm.
But all the mechanics are using tools from China, stuff like that, you know? So I'm like, I can't do it here. And my wife's like, let's move to San Diego. So we moved up there, and I did an auto shop program at a junior college over there. And there they had an intern program where dealerships went to the school and interviewed you, and they'd hire you, you know, at a starting thing. So I did that, and I, you know, did it for 30 years until recently. Now I'm a full-time artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
And it's crazy that, you know, it wasn't something that you had planned and it just happened.
No, yeah. And I've never been like a gearhead where I'm like doing it all day and I'm doing side work and all this. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, it was just something I did. Like, my friends all laugh because I, you know, bullshit them like, hey, man, my car's broken. You look at it. It's, man, that needs a special tool, and I don't have that tool. And so they always joke, hey, did you bring that special tool? because I knew I just didn't want to work on it, because it just like any free time I wanted to do art or hang out. I didn't want to be under a car and this and that. And then especially when you when you're buying stuff from like aftermarket auto parts, they're universal, so they don't really fit well. So it's like sometimes it turns a 1 hour job to a 6 hour job because you have to figure out how do you make this work that works on 10 different cars.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm like, ah, screw that. I don't need that. Especially once I started doing art, like painting wise, I didn't want all my free time was devoted to like, I just want to paint. I just want to draw, just whatever, you know?
So, in between, you know, going to high school and IVC and all these, when was it that you remember that you're like, you know what? I'm pretty good at drawing.
I could always draw since I was a kid, and I always checked out even like in elementary, like the kids' library. I always checked out drawing books and doing little cartoon characters and stuff like that. And then in like fifth, sixth grade, I really got into music, and I would draw like logos of bands, you know, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, like in their font, stuff like that. And junior high, I started drawing like redoing like album covers, like Iron Maiden, Number of the Beast or whatever. And, you know, it's got a lot of detail. So I always do that. And then in high school, I collected a lot of like Mad Magazine. So I would draw all the characters, especially like Don Martin, the guy with the long face and the long nose. And so I drew that everywhere and stuff. And I always loved to draw. I wanted to go to art school, but my mom was like, you know, you grew up in the valley. She's like, what are you going to do with that? And she knew I couldn't be in an office. So she's like, you need to do something like vocational, you know, construction or a plumber or something or other. So, and not that I was looking for it, but like I said, that's kind of by accident. My friend's like, oh, I'll take an auto shop class. And that's where I ended up, which I preferred being in a shop.
Yeah. Then,
you know, I hate being in an office. It's just not me. But I always drew. I took a like an art class in high school, but that sucked. Like the lady, the teacher, and I've never run into somebody that taught art that wasn't open-minded. But I spent all this time on this image, and yeah, it had stuff, you know, kind of like death metal style. And she just like looked at it and she tore it up. She's like, "Oh, this is trash. You should like as an artist." You should be open to anything, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, all right, well, that was bullshit. You know, now I don't want to do shit here. And so I would draw, I would make something look nice, but if you look in the crosshatching or whatever, I, you know, draw a penis on there or something, you know, something like a little F you to her, you know? So I was like, that was a downer, you know?
Do you remember the teacher's name?
Harmon, I believe.
She's probably, yeah.
Yeah. But then I took classes in IVC, and I loved it. I loved it there. There was a teacher that was really good at teaching and stuff. And, I mean, there's stuff that I picked up from her drawing classes that I still think about when I paint. You know, like, you know, there should be a shadow here because of this or a highlight. Or so that was good. And then I even got a little scholarship from IVC. And it was funny because it was some cash. And then it was a membership to this artist guild in IVC, and not in IVC, in what's it called? Like the JCPenney Mall.
Oh, Valley Plaza?
Yeah. So there was like this artist colony or whatever. So I showed up, and at the time, all I did was like kind of characters, and they're pretty, you know, Beavis and Butthead, you know, type of Ren and Stimpy characters. And I went in there with all these drawings, and everybody's drawing cactus and desert scenes and flowers. And they're looking at me like, okay. And I'm like, I mean, I took out one look at what was in there. I'm like, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm not, this is not for me.
This is not for me. Yeah.
So and, that, oh, go ahead.
So then I moved to San Diego, and I always drew, but I never painted. And probably like in 99, my mom was like, oh, you should take an oil painting class. You know, because she wanted me to paint roosters for her kitchen and all this and shit like oil paints. And I took the class, and the first semester is more you have assignments to kind of learn how to control paint. So that, but there's other people in the class that are in advanced classes, and then when you get there, all you have to do is paint a series, something that's linked to bit together. It could be the fact that you just use blue paint, or that you use lettering, or whatever. As long as it's a body of work that's tied together. And I was like, damn, dude, I want to do that. Like, screw this, you know, assignment shit. But I mean, it was necessary because you need to learn how to blend and all this. And once I got in that second semester, I think the first painting I did was this guy that OD'd in the bathtub. And it says Calesia on his stomach. And it was just kind of based on a few friends OD'd. They were heroin addicts and they OD'd here in Calexico. Mm-hmm. And they all OD'd in the bathtub.
Oh,
because it was a room with a lock. And they could say, hey, I'm going to take a bath. Leave me alone for a while. And so I did it based on that. And it got such a reaction in the class that automatically I felt like when you do punk flyers that are extreme, a guy cutting off his own hand or whatever. So even though it wasn't that, I was getting that same feeling of a punk flyer or a death metal cover or whatever, you know. And the teacher I had, he was a well-known Chicano artist, and he kind of like saw what I was doing, and so he kind of like led me to like the path that I'm on, you know, as far as Chicano art and stuff like that. And but I was doing, I like that, I guess, shock value.
Yeah.
So
for I was trying to think of the word.
Yeah. So probably for like the first 3 years, I painted nothing but dead people and like murder scenes and stuff like that. And people in class are like, damn, like, what are you doing? So I joke with them every once in a while. I'd like, I'm painting, and I'm like holding my thumb like I'm painting them, you know? And they're like, what the fuck? But after a while, you know, you can only paint so many dead people before you get bored, you know? So then I started painting poverty, like stuff that other people maybe don't see or aren't familiar because they maybe live in La Jolla or something. They don't know this stuff like poverty. And it was poverty here and poverty in Mexico, you know, people begging for money or a homeless person, stuff like that. So I started doing more struggle. And then eventually I started doing bar shows that were more fun, you know. And so they were more tongue-in-cheek, joking. And so that's kind of when I developed the style that I do now, where sometimes it's funny, but there's a message, you know. So there were still like Mexican situations, but with a twist. But it's also, if you look at it, there's a message about it. You know, and then I eventually did this solo show called Toys Aren't Us.
Toys Aren't Us,
based on the fact that most toys were white. So that's when I started doing toys converted to Chicano versions of them. You know, so I did like the little people from Fisher-Price, but, you know, there was, I think the original one was like Zapata and Che and Subcomandante Marco. And I did other characters like with the using the little people, and I did the Green Army men, but they were Zapatistas. I did the Operation Game, but instead of bones, they're classic Chicano tattoos, you know, the spider web, the a knife, stuff like that, your mom's name, and a wagon, a red wagon, but it's a lowrider wagon. And that's kind of what I would say, that's my biggest thing that I sell now, is these toys converted to like Chicano versions of them. I do Weeble Wobbles now, what I call my Weevil Wobbles, you know. And but it all kind of was a transition. It was a transition.
Right? And you know, I noticed that you have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And you incorporated into your art, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's something that people say about my work. And along with drawing books, I was always loved joke books. So throughout elementary, like, I checked out every joke book. And then in junior high, I started buying these, they're called Truly Tasteless Joke Books. And they're like pretty extreme, and they're broken up into chapters, you know, black, Mexican, this and that, handicap. And it's just everything. And I would carry around like 7 volumes of it, you know, like in junior high. And just like, I knew every joke there was, you know. So I think that development kind of sinks into my art now, because I think I always have a little, you know, there's like some fun to the to the piece.
Yeah. You know, I asked you about the music, and then because now that, you know, you're, it's kind of like two different kind of genres. Like when you were growing up, you're death metal.
Yeah.
And now, like, most of your artists, you know, Chicano based. Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, did you feel like, you know, did you feel Chicano, or was it now that you were in the art scene that you kind of?
Not here in Calexico. Here in Calexico, I think I never really, I guess I wasn't around that term, but I think it's more when I moved to San Diego that I really saw, like, the racism that you start, you know, just like, hey, I'm going to be here because this is where you feel safe type of thing, mm-hmm. you know, and I ran into a lot of that there. And then being in the punk scene and all that, the clubs I went to, there were skinheads, there was Nazis that would show up, and me and my friend would go in there, and we're always in there, and the owner, he's like, hey, man, you guys are always in here. Free beer anytime you want, as long as you help the security guard if there's an issue. They're like, yeah, whatever. Punch a Nazi, okay. You know, so beer, yeah. So that's what we did, and it was, and that's when I felt like not connected. And then we were living not too far from Chicano Park. We were living in downtown when we first moved there, and then we ended up randomly at Chicano Park, and it was Chicano Park Day. And we walked around, and it's like, holy shit, like, I feel home. Mm-hmm. I feel a connection. It reminded me of in Calexico when they had the big fiestas, you know, 16th of September, mm-hmm. all this, that they got, you know, food booths and music and all this. So right away, we both felt this connection. And so I never forgot that. So we would go to Chicano Park every year. You know, it's not like we hung out there, but we did that. But then when the art scene kind of moved there, I mean, it felt right, you know, like, you know, and then that's when I was kind of like, you know, okay, I am Chicano, you know, and I identified, I think, more so because it's like you need to have a click or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, and here everybody's Mexican, you know, the majority,
pretty much.
So I don't see where here you would be like using that term. Mm-hmm.
Again, know? And I feel that, it's a common thing, you know, people mm-hmm. leave the valley mm-hmm. and they see all the racism or discrimination yeah. and they, like you mentioned, you need to find somewhere where you feel at home, at phase, where you can relax, where you can, you know, speak Spanglish or Spanish and, you know, be okay. And yeah, and because when I grew up in high school, I think that was like some of the first time or the first time when they started teaching like Chicano studies mm-hmm. and, you know, Chicano drama, like all these, you know, they started incorporating Chicano. And you know, I feel that a lot of the people that were taking those classes or consider themselves Chicanos were mm-hmm. people that came from... A lot of friends that came from Salinas or stuff that, they came to the Valley. You know, they were the ones that, you know, were in the Mecha Club.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, like, I was always like, you know, well, I like the culture, you know, mm-hmm. I like the oldies. I like, you know, Blood In, Blood Out, Mercury, like all those. But I don't know. It was hard for me to kind of understand, you know, what a Chicano is. And that's something that I asked, like, a lot of people that, you know,
yeah, I know. I heard a podcast with Roberto Pozos, mm. and I know him from San Diego. But I know, you know, he does a lot with that, and I think he was in Mecha and all that. Mm. But yeah, it's something I don't know. It's like a support, I guess, and I guess being in the scene, you see a lot of like poets talking about it, and then it hits you like, yeah, you know, I was treated like this, you know, and. And it gives you some strength, mm-hmm. you know. I have some friends that are in a comedy group that have been around like 35, maybe 40 years, Culture Clash. And they would do plays all over universities, all over the U.S. and stuff. And they were talking about that forever, and you'd go to one of their plays and it's talking about that, and it's like, you're right, you know, like, we need to stick together to, I mean, even like the walkouts, I mean, that was based on the Chicano movement, because if not, they never taught anybody advanced courses, because they're like, oh, they're going to be a waiter, they're going to be a busboy, they're going to be this, let's not waste time on that. And it wasn't until the Chicano movement that pushed all that agenda to where, why aren't we getting better books if the other school is getting better books? And that's all created by that Chicano movement, you know, that they realize, hey, if we don't show up to school, they don't get paid, you know, so let's stay out of school. And that affected them, right? That affected the school.
Their pockets, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and I remember asking, I think it was Eric Reyes. I don't know if you know Eric Reyes. He's from Brawley.
Sounds familiar.
He was a teacher in Calexico for a while. And I asked him, like for him, what it meant to be a Chicano. Mm-hmm. And I think the way he described it, kind of like, I understand. And now that's how I kind of feel like it's kind of like a state of mind, you know, being part of this, you know, this culture. And yeah, like to me, like told him, yeah, and then I guess I'm, you know, might not always be a Chicano, but there's times when I, you know, feel like, you know.
Well, the fact that you stand up for yourself if you see something that's wrong, you know, because a lot of times people wouldn't say anything, or it's all about appearance or acting the way that they expect you to act. Mm. You know, like, I mean, even like say with me with long hair, my mom was like, hey, when are you going to cut it? And she was worried about what other people were going to say. And to me, I was like, who cares what they say? Yeah. I don't care what anybody says, you know, and that's what I'm going to do, you know? And so it's that state of mind where it's funny because like my grandmother wasn't like that, but my mom was more, oh, what are they going to say in church? What are they going to say here? What are they going to say there? And the older generation, you know, they just kind of, you know, life was rougher. So they're like, hey, whatever, that doesn't matter. You know, just as long as you're working, as long as this, you know, like
surviving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, yeah, it was harder for our grandparents. I mean, I'm first generation here, but, you know, my grandparents, even Mexicali, you know, that's where they live. You know, they had it rough, you know.
Yeah.
And then my dad came over here and, he had a little bit better, so, but yeah, they had it. You know, our grandparents didn't have, you know, a harder time. You know, especially you know, my dad had, I think it was like 9 siblings. So like you know, or our grandparents had bigger families too.
Yeah, I think my dad, they were 14.
Are your parents from the valley también or?
Yeah, essentially, my dad was born in Sonora, but they moved here when they were babies. You know. But so they've been in Mexicali for years. I still have a lot of family in Mexicali. And then my mom was born in Indio. But her family was from Sonora also.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. Sorry for the interruption. But I wanted to take this time to thank my sponsors. I want to thank my longtime sponsors, my friend Camilo Garcia, Eddie Lopez from Roots Creative, and my friend Jake. Thank you guys for being longtime sponsors of the podcast. I also want to thank my friends who sponsored the podcast in 2022. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your sponsorship. And if you want to become a sponsor, you can go to anchor.fm/quepasacalexico. Hit the support button and you can sponsor the podcast from 99 cents a month to $10 a month. It really helps me a lot to make this podcast better, sound better, look better, and reach out more people by promoting the podcast and social media and other websites. So if you want to become a sponsor, make sure to go to my Anchor page and I'll leave a link, also leave a link in the description of the show. So thank you so much. And now back to the show. So now that you're doing this full time, do you think you have, is it harder for you to like not have a 9 to 5 and then, or is it better, do you find it better to focus on your art than?
I mean, I guess it's harder, more stressful, but I enjoy it. Where the 9 to 5 was like, I was working, but I was always thinking about art the whole time. Like 30 years, I was like, while I was working, I was thinking about art. You know, especially when I started, I was like, that's what I was all about. You know, like I was doing shows like every 2 weeks, and people are like, man, how are you getting all these shows? Like, but like I always tell people, like, if you don't hang out, nobody's ever going to discover you being locked away in your house. Mm. It doesn't matter how great, amazing artist you are. If you're not out there, how are people going to know about you? So I was always out, you know. I'd go to work and I'd come home and I'd paint, and then I'd go out all night. And that's where I made a lot of connections, through meeting poets, meeting artists, meeting musicians, you know, because they all run in the same circles. You know, if you have an art show, you're going to have a musician or a DJ play, and it's all kind of intertwined and stuff. But I always tell people, you know, younger artists, like, dude, you have to go out. You can't just be, because that's where you're going to make your connections. And if you look at history, every famous artist has a painting of a cafe in France or a bar or whatever, because that's where they got together and they had common bonds of whether the art they were doing or doing rebellious shit, you know, like, hey, I'm going to paint, you know, cubism. You know, the people are like, what the fuck is that? It's shit. And yet now it's the most expensive artwork, yeah. You know, even like the impressionists, where it's just kind of like blotches. From far, it looks like a realism, but you look close and it's just a mess, you know? Mm-hmm. And people thought that was shit. And now that's one of the most expensive pieces too.
Yeah.
But those artists would get together and they would hang out together, and you see all their paintings, and they're at this cafe, at this bar, and it's like, you, that's how you make connections, you know? You're not going to get anywhere if you're just sitting at home.
Yeah.
Just like a band, you know, if you don't do a gig here and there, how the hell is anybody going to know? If you put it on the internet, still, you got to do the local thing.
Yeah, whatever. And especially, like, say you go to a bar, you play, and there's somebody, a couple people there that listen to, they liked it, they share it with somebody else, mm-hmm. and, you know, that's, like, how they spread. So what would be your drawing of the bar that you mentioned, you know, there's mm-hmm. artists that have a cafe or a bar. What would be the one you...
I would say... There's a bar that I used to hang out at that it used to be, it was actually a block away from where I first moved to San Diego, and there was a bar next to me and I hung out there. But then there was a bar about a block away that nobody ever went in there. It was like my friend calls it bar monsters. It was like the daytime drinkers that are, you know, they just like get 2-3 super strong drinks and pass out. Mm. It was that type of bar. Like, it closed at like 9. And then one day I saw my homie out there, and he's worked at a bunch of bars in San Diego, and he was a DJ. He's like, hey man, I just took over this bar. Like, why don't you cruise by? He's all right. And he's been in the bar industry forever, especially being a DJ and all that. And he was a graffiti artist. So he put out a velvet rope, and this is like a grimy, grimy bar. And all of a sudden it was like, man, there's a velvet rope. But he was smart enough to where you walked in, and if somebody else walked in and he knew him, he's like, hey, so-and-so, this is so-and-so, and you talk. And now when you go in there, if that guy's there, you feel comfortable. Yeah. And that he did that to everybody. Whoever you were sitting next to, hey, this is so-and-so, I don't know if you met him, he's an artist. Oh, this guy's a tattoo artist. This guy's a graffiti artist. And before you know it, it became this underground, super popular spot. And it was like a lot of like regulars, and there was a lot. I mean, it was so cool that, I mean, like the guy from The Roots DJ'd there. And this is like a little grimy divey bar. Yeah. And the guy from The Roots was there. There was a line around the block, and it's like, they're never going to get in because nobody's going to leave.
Yeah.
Or even though there was a line, because we were like regulars, we were there 7 days a week.
Mm.
You walk up and like, what line? I don't see no line. You just walk in. But there were so many like famous people in there, and it was super grimy, but that's what made it cool.
Mm.
Then they had a DJ, and the police department was half a block up, and they started getting, I think they were getting trouble because they didn't have a cabaret license. So there was apartments on top of it, really old apartments. So the manager lived upstairs. So he literally ran a wire from his apartment to the bar, and he had his little pencil camera. And so the DJs would DJ in his kitchen.
Oh, wow.
And on the TVs, you could see the DJs DJing in his kitchen. Uh-huh. And they were getting around the law by not having the DJ in the bar. And then I take off and I go up there. He's like, how the hell did you get up there? You know? And then the guy that used to wash dishes in the bar, he'd go up there and wash the guy's dishes and stuff. But then later they got a better camera and it kind of killed it. Like it was better when it was grimy.
Yeah, grimy and all, yeah.
But we did a lot of art shows there. And I think it's just the amount of people that you never knew you were next to, you know, famous DJs, famous artists. And there was a gallery right next door that I used to show at.
Where do you think like a grimy spot like that would become like the place to be?
I think that place was because of the fact that he introduced everybody and you felt at home no matter what day you went, because you're going to run into somebody you've been introduced to. Mm. It's like that comfort of you walk in and it doesn't matter what day you walk in, you're going to know somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, like feeling like a regular.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I think that because here in Calexico, we have 111. It's mm-hmm. been, but now it's under new
ownership.
This girl from Mexicali, she plays in the band. Mm. She bought it probably like, I don't know if it was like months before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And she was struggling to keep it open. She's still open. But yeah, I feel like it. There's a guy there. Shout out to Ruben. He's always there. And he tries to talk to everybody.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what, you know.
Yeah. But I would recommend, like, for the owner, if she knows people, introduce them, because that is going to pay off in the end. You know, you got a dude that hangs out there and somebody else, and you never know what people are into. There was a guy that used to hang out there that was way older, and you know, he was kind of like, you get there, get fucked up and leave, sometimes carried out, but you would never expect the job he had. Like, he worked in television, and in talking to him, it's like, oh, he used to box and he had a nose, you could tell he was a boxer. And then he worked in television. I'm like, oh shit. Like, but you would never know it. But after that, like, you could tell he was comfortable, because, you know, we're like, hey, what's up, Larry, or whatever, you know. And it's just introducing everybody to everybody. People are going to want to come more because they're like, hey, man, like, you know, Larry said he's going to be there, or whoever, you know. And you go because you want to hang out, you know, where sometimes here in the Valley, you can't find what to do, right? Like, you're like cruising around everywhere, like, man, there's nothing. Mm. But if you have that, no matter what day you go, you're going to know somebody.
Somebody, yeah.
And I think that's what really made that place.
Yeah, and especially here, it's easier to kind of do that because it's a smaller town.
Yeah.
And, like, probably the same people are going to be there. Yeah, yeah. It's easier to kind of bring that vibe, that environment to
us. Yeah, I tell that to everybody. Like, dude, like, if you have a spot, like, if you know somebody sitting next to somebody, introduce them and tell them what they do. And I mean, it's not only like, it might be business for them. If it was a tattoo artist, you know, I meet him, like, I might want a tattoo from him, or art, you know, he might want to buy an art piece, and it's going to work out for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, if you go in there and it's dead, oh, there's just two people and I don't know them, I'm going to leave after one beer. But if you introduce everybody, you're going to go and you're going to sit next to them because you know them. And then you're probably going to have two or three beers. Mm. So it's good for the business too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
Going back to art, and it's something that I kind of ask people that have gone and, you know, become a little bit, they make it into a career. Do you think that here in the Valley, you would be able to do, you know, say like, I'm going to quit my job or retire from a job and do this full time?
A career? No, not in painting or anything like that. Maybe in doing stuff with computers, like advertisement, something like that. But as far as art goes, I don't see it happening right now. I think when I've done shows here, I've done it just because friends asked me to. Mm. But sales, the amount of money that people are willing to pay for art is not what it should be. Mm-hmm. You know, and I understand
the struggle,
the economics of the Valley, you mm-hmm. know. You know, and it's really just comes down to that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the first show I did was it was in El Centro, with
the kayak.
At the kayak, the guy that owned the kayak.
Yeah, what's his name?
Jared Storm. Mm-hmm. It was at his gallery. He had a little gallery. And there were some tattoo artists that had some work there that was pretty amazing. And then it's like $40. I'm like, dude, like, if you spent 4 hours on the piece, like, what's the dollar amount you're working for per mm-hmm. hour, you know? Like really? And I think maybe people don't understand, too. They're like, oh, I like the piece. But you got to think how many hours did they spend on that piece.
Material.
And as an artist, you should think, how many hours did I spend? What's minimum wage? You know, at least that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least that. But it shouldn't be that, but at least that. And I see it all the time with young artists that one of the hardest thing to do is decide to say you're an artist. You know, to tell people, yeah, I'm an artist. Like, whether you have a 9-to-5, but if you do art, it takes a long time for people to say, oh, I'm an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next step is pricing. I mean, I try to help out. People ask me all the time, and I said, okay, well, you know, I don't think if it's original, I don't think it should be cheaper than, like, say if it's a painting, I don't think it should be cheaper than $100 if it's a one of a kind. And then you put it in a show. But you, as an artist, need to go to a lot of shows. And then you see stuff that's sold. You say, hey, that sold for $150. I think my stuff's the same or better. If that sold for $150, okay, I'm going to bump it up to $160. And you keep doing that, and you see other work, and it's like, well, it sold over here for $300.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't my stuff be $300? And that's kind of how you develop your pricing. But I don't know, when I see stuff for $40-$60 that's original, it just seems kind of like a crime.
Yeah.
You know, like, it shouldn't be that. You should take a little more pride in the work that you do.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, you know, here, you know, people are going to decide whether they want to pay $100 for a piece or maybe take out their family to eat.
Yeah.
You know, the difference and you know, the economics is...
Yeah. But, I mean, I think what they could do also is sell the piece for $150 or $200 or $300, whatever it is, depending on the work, but make prints and sell prints. Sell prints for $20, $30, $40.
Mm-hmm.
Sell that, but the original, if somebody really likes it so much, then whoever really wants it, they say, man, I'd love to have the original. Then you sell the original for more money. Don't sell the original for
what you would sell.
$40, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you go work anywhere, minimum wage, and 2-3 hours, mm-hmm. you're going to have that money. Like this is a one-of-a-kind piece that you created. Like, don't diminish it, you know, that it's...
And do you think sometimes it's... They kind of set the price that way because... They see it, you know, they might have their 9-to-5 and then they see this, you know, as a hobby or.
Yeah. I mean, I think that happens or everybody has that mindset. So the price stays that low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the price stays that low. Like normally in San Diego, like I try not to do big group shows that have a lot of people that are maybe starting out because. You know, they're always going to, you're going to run into that where they're like, oh, I'll give it away for free if somebody wants it. And then it makes you look like an asshole because you're asking for $500.
Mm.
But, I mean, I've been doing it a long time and I've made a name for myself. And I mean, I can't work for free, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but that takes a long time to develop you to say, hey, my stuff is worth this, you know? Mm-hmm.
Have you had any, you know, artists from the Valley, you know, reach out to... You know, for any advice or?
Oh, people hit me up all the time.
Mm.
There's one guy, and I don't know his last name, but I went to high school with his mom. But his Instagram is just Felix. I don't know if you know him.
No.
But he does, he's painting a lot of murals in restaurants here in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also, I just bought a piece from him. He did a rug. He makes rugs. And... my homie Chicle, he does all the design work for like Emo Brown. So there's a character he did for Emo Brown that's like the skeleton with a flipped up hat and a bandana that kinda says like South Bay, but I had him put his signature on there. And so he did a 3-foot rug for me, and I gave it to Chicle for his birthday.
Oh, cool.
And he's doing some pretty cool work.
Mm-hmm.
I think he paints shoes and stuff like that. And yeah, and I think he heard the podcast I was on with Tribal, the Lower Left podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was talking to his parents, and his mom's like, oh, I went to high school with him. And then he hit me up, and I just kind of gave him some advice on paint and stuff like that. And we just kind of kept in contact. And so recently, a week ago, he came up there to give me that rug.
Mm-hmm.
So Chicle was having a show.
So Felix is his handle?
Yeah, just Felix.
Okay.
Yeah. But he's from here, from Calexico.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I think his dad might be like a fireman or something or other.
Oh, okay. I'll look him up.
Yeah. But I don't know his last name.
Okay. So what was my question? I had a question then, and then I lost. So what do you call the style of, you know, your paintings?
You know, I always have a tough time with that question. I mean, it's the general, I guess it's Chicano art, but it's been named several things. Pop art, post-surrealism, folk artish. I don't know. It's just, I don't really know, other than to me, it's more about cultural identity, you know, because I don't do one style, you know, I'll do
mm-hmm.
regular portraits. I do skulls, skeletons. I do the toys. So I guess it doesn't all mix, because I really just do whatever I feel like doing. Like, I don't like to do a body of work, because every day you feel different, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one day you're happy, one day you're pissed or whatever. So I see the same as a body of work. I know artists do, like, I'm going to paint a whole body of work for this show. And I always try to title everything like Random Thoughts or stuff like that, because I have a lot of ideas, and I want to do this toy thing, and I want to do this bloody thing, and I want to do this. And so I don't like doing like one theme. I do toys, but I usually don't do like just a toy theme other than the first one I did. I do different stuff. So.
Yeah, because I've seen, you know, it varies. You
yeah,
know? It's not always the
yeah,
same.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you do have, I guess, like the toy is something that you come back to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because I think those are the ones that people really like. That and the skeletons, like the Dia de los Muertos. Not Dia de los Muertos, but like, say, like the shirt. You know, like people love like the skeleton stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I do the skeleton stuff. I can't. Everything I paint sells. The toys, they all sell. So those are, you know, I would say the majority that I paint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had a like a Pez.
Yeah.
And then like the little, what was it, little guys? That's what they're called?
Yeah, little people.
Little people.
And the Weeble Wobbles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do you ever use, is all you do, everything you do is painted, not on computer?
No, I don't. I'm very computer literate. Extremely computer literate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because I know, do you know Fernando Reza?
No.
No, he does post like movie posters for like Sony and stuff like that.
He's no, but I heard the podcast he was on.
Mm.
Yeah, but no, I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, on computer.
Yeah. I think I was a little late in the game. Like, computers first came around when I was in high school, and that was only for the advanced students. So I never touched it. And then my wife bought one when we were up there, but I was just, you know, I was always out, so I just never been around enough. And even when I bought one, like, people would joke, mess with me, because I bought an Apple computer, like, when they did the one that
was
the half ball and the screen. I bought it, and it literally sat in the box in my kitchen for, like, 6 months. And then it's like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I don't know how to set it up. So what do you mean? He's like, well, let me have it, and then when you're ready, like, I'll give it back to you. And then finally, like, because I didn't know how to set up, like, just for, like, you know, the modem or anything, like.
Like for the internet?
Yeah. I'm like, I mean, I was that clueless, you know?
Yeah.
And even, like, social media, like, my homie Chicle, he was the one that, hey, you got to get a MySpace, you know, advertise shows. And then so he set it up for me. And then when Facebook came around, he set it up for me, you know. I mean, now I'm better at it, but...
You do your own social media stuff? Or
yeah.
Because, yeah, it's... I mean, social... That's how I find a lot of, mm-hmm. you know... I think that's how I found you. Especially here in the Valley, a lot of people that I mm-hmm. that I found that are artists is through Instagram is,
yeah.
I think, the biggest...
Yeah, Facebook, you don't see too much on there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like, I mean, when I started, everything was flyers, even to show in a place, everybody requires slides. And I was like, how the hell do you get a slide, you know? Then I had to get a friend to come over and shoot slides. And then you had to shoot, I forgot, I think they called it bracketing, where you shoot at three different exposures, because depending on the painting, one exposure might be better. So you were taking three photos of each piece, and then you develop them. And then it's like, okay, this one looks more like it. This one looks more like it. So then you just waste all these.
Yeah.
And then eventually, you know, digital came in, and it's like people wanted a disc, you know, of your work. And now pretty much you just refer them to
a website or
to a website or whatever, yeah. or a social media.
You have a website as well?
No, I had one, and nothing ever came of it. Nobody ever hit me up. Hey, I saw your website.
Mm, yeah.
So I'm like, screw that. You know, so I just social media.
Yeah, I think I have a website. And to be honest, it's been like a year and a half since I updated it.
Yeah.
I see, you know, I see people going in there every so often, but it's not enough for me to.
Yeah. It's almost better just to have a social media
mm-hmm.
for what you do.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like websites, I think they're kind of on the way out too, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you have a business where.
Well, yeah. Especially like if you can buy stuff off your website, you know, yeah. that's the best thing. But yeah, for me that it's a podcast, it's like, a lot of the times the website is just there to redirect somebody to my social media or Spotify or whatever. But yeah, yeah. I don't have the time for a website right now.
Yeah. And like me, like I just have like a big cartel page where, you know, it's kind of like Facebook. It's a business page you order and you just link it to your social media.
Mm.
And then you just put whatever name, you know, ricardoislas.bigcartel.com. Oh, okay. And there I just upload products and people. And then when you open it, you get a PayPal account. Like they work with PayPal, so you're paying through the website, and PayPal takes taxes and all that. And
oh, okay. So yeah, it's you don't have to
deal with it. And you just upload it just like if you're uploading pictures in Facebook or Instagram or whatever.
Okay, cool. So we're almost at an hour now, and I try to keep them like
yeah.
Is there anything that I didn't ask you or we talked about that you would like to?
No, I hope to do more shows down here. You know, I tried going to it's a cultural center here, though,
uh-huh.
but it seems like they do stuff more on weekdays.
Yeah.
So it's kind of tough to get out here, but I'd like to check that out. I did come once for the Domingo Ulloa show they had several years ago before pandemic. But I'd like to do more stuff here.
You know, they've done here in Calexico, they've done, you know, Roberto Pozos was here one time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure like if you ever need a spot, like it would be down to host here.
Yeah. It's just tough when it's a weekday.
Mm-hmm. No, and they can do it on a weekend. Mm-hmm. If you're ever need a spot, you can probably get their info and they'll be down to host.
That'd be cool.
But
I'm glad to see that there's more of an art scene now. Because when I was here, there was no art scene mm-hmm. here. Nothing at all. And now I see they were having like the art walk and stuff like that. And I think a cousin of mine was started that with some other people.
Who's your cousin?
Roxana.
Oh, okay. Pacheco. I had her last week.
Yeah.
I talked to her last week. Oh, cool. I didn't know she was your cousin.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. It's funny that I had her last week. She was on the podcast this week. But yeah, I think more people are feeling comfortable because like when you mentioned that sometimes it's hard for you to call yourself an artist.
Yeah.
I think more people are feeling more comfortable. And I think especially Instagram has a lot to do with it because people that are looking for artists, that's where they go to. And I think that it helps, you know, bring people out, and especially here in Calexico in the Valley.
Yeah, and I've met a lot more now that I did like the Viva del Valle show and all that. And I've met a lot of artists, but mainly from El Centro, Imperial and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, El Centro has a lot of, I always talk about Jared and when he had the kayak.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they have this little clique where they support each other. And I think it's really, really fun that they do, really cool that they do that kind of thing. So, like Ernie, the guy that owns Meshka, he always tries to like organize events where they, not only art, well, I mean, yeah, it's artists because they, you know, they have like little events where people can set up their booth and sell their prints, stickers, jewelry. And I think that's something that's missing here in Calexico también.
Yeah, and I think once you start doing more events like that, it becomes more of a community. And I mean, just like Logan, there was no art when the first gallery moved there. And it was rough when they first moved there. You know, he was, you know, homies were going in there, what the fuck is this, you know? And it's like, but he's cool with them. And sometimes he's like, hey, you got to fight, you know? But then it succeeded, and then it pretty much developed what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
From people that hung out at that gallery, they all spread and opened up their own spots and stuff. So, I mean, there's good and bad, I guess. Like, the good part is it changed the scene, but the bad part is gentrification sets in.
It's sometimes it's hard because you want to see like a community get better, but sometimes, you know, that you know, it turns into something else that you weren't expecting, and it impacts, you know, people that were living there for you know, years and years, that it gets harder for them to like pay rent and stuff.
Yeah,
like
pay
that.
Rent. That's the first thing that goes.
Well, Ricardo, thank you for especially reaching out, because like I told you, you know, I was about to, you know, reach out to somebody and, you know, see if they wanted to be on. And then you sent me a message, and it was like, you know, perfect timing. And it's, I'm glad, because we you know, I know we talked about it in the past about you coming on the podcast and you know, having the chat.
Yeah.
And
thank you. I mean, it always seems like I come just for a few hours and I leave. So I'm like, man, I could never do it.
Yeah.
And this time I was like, you know, I'm going to be there on a Saturday, like, screw it, like, let's do it.
Yeah, you know, for so, sure. Thank you.
I enjoy the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for the conversation. And where can people, you know, find your stuff? What's your
Instagram? It's Real Ricardo Islas, and on Facebook it's just Ricardo Islas.
Okay, and I'll put links on the description of today's episode so people can check it out and follow you and you know, see if you have any shows coming up and stuff.
Yeah,
like
for
that.
Sure. Thank you.
Now that you're, you know, doing it full time, you know.
Yeah,
for sure. All right, guys, well, thank you so much for listening or watching, and we'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.